All right, it's a good old-fashioned emergency pod. McCarthy might need Democratic votes, but it sounds like he's not going to get them to remain Speaker. We know that that's going to, I mean, it's going to cause all sorts of chaos, and we're live to monitor it as it happens. From the producers of the once we get through that, from the producers of the Trump lawsuits and the Trump indictments, a new series premiered this week, The Trump Trials. Remember General John Kelly, Trump's chief of staff that always looked like a disappointed hostage? He confirmed Trump is every bit as bad as we thought. What would it take for this to actually matter? Welcome to the podcast that helps you, the 54% of the country that votes for progress in every election, convince your conservative friends and family members to join a majority. This is Majority 54.
All right, Jason. I feel like I'm really reneging on my responsibilities as a New York legal correspondent. I'm all the way out here in Sri Lanka where it's 10:30 at night, and I've been catching up on just like what a week to be away. I was like, oh yeah, like let me see what's happened over there in the United States, and I've spent all day just consuming information about the late breaking Trump trial, you know, McCarthy in trouble. But I figure we should start with McCarthy because we've been talking about this since he made the deal with the devil, where it essentially takes very few votes to vacate the speakership, or at least call a vote on the speakership, and he's now in trouble here. There, as we speak, the House is getting ready to vote on this motion from Matt Gaetz. And we should probably start with Matt Gaetz in his own words here.
Especially because you said, you know, made the deal with the devil. Like, he became Speaker because he finally made a deal with Matt Gaetz. And now the devil has come back to repossess his soul, I guess. I think we should start with Gaetz.
Yeah, this is Gaetz when he filed the motion.
For what purposes does the gentleman from Florida now seek recognition?
Mr. Speaker, pursuant to Clause 2A1 of Rule 9, I rise to give notice of my intent to raise a question of the privileges of the House.
The gentleman will state the form of his resolution.
Declaring the office of Speaker of the House of Representatives to be vacant, resolved that the office of Speaker of the House of Representatives is hereby declared to be vacant.
Okay, so that's apparently all that takes to get this S-storm started. So now, what's going on right now, Robbie? Do you know from Sri Lanka, or you want me to do my best?
Well, from what I'm understanding, they're getting ready to vote, and everybody's confirming what they plan to do. So certain, you know, Republicans who are on the fence are stating their intentions. So Dan Bishop, for instance, just tweeted essentially that he is going to support McCarthy. Others have done videos and tweeted the opposite. It looks like McCarthy, Gaetz has the votes to vacate the speakership unless Democrats come to McCarthy's aid. Hakeem Jeffries has said that Democrats will not support McCarthy, and certain members of the sort of Problem Solvers Coalition, like the more centrist Democrats like Abigail Spanberger, have also indicated that they do not plan to support McCarthy. So unless they're lawyering their language and they plan to vote present, for example, you know, which is one thing they could do, the Democrats could vote present and change the math. But it doesn't seem like they intend to do that. It doesn't seem like they intend to do anything to help McCarthy.
Yeah, so for people who don't know, if they vote present, the way it changes the math is it's just like decreases the, like you need a percentage of the people who are voting, right? So what I wanted, before we even go down the road of like what's going to happen with the Republicans, I think it's important to talk about what could have happened with the Democrats and what I think McCarthy may have been hoping for. Because I can remember when I was in the State House, we had, you know, there was a Republican majority, we had a Republican speaker, but there were certain things, because at that time they didn't have a supermajority, so it's a little different because it wasn't about a speaker's vote, but there were certain times when they wanted to move forward, they wanted to bring a bill up, and then be able to call a vote on it. And in order to do that, they at that time needed a few Democrats to vote with them. And there were three or four Democrats who would occasionally do that. And they would get things like prime committee assignments. They got stuff that is really trivial, but it was a big deal to people in the House. Like, they got to have their office on the third floor where the House chamber was, which everybody else there was a Republican. So there was a path for that to happen. Like, there's a world in which McCarthy does a power sharing, not even a power sharing agreement, just picks off a few centrist Democrats and they get all sorts of stuff. They can go back to the district and say, yeah, look at what I got because of this. But interestingly, they had a caucus meeting and they took everybody's phones so that there wouldn't be like recorded leaks, at least. And they probably had it out. There were probably some people who were getting up and saying, look, we don't know what they're going to come up with if it's not McCarthy. People making a case for that. And ultimately came out. And so far, they're saying, we're totally united. Like, none of us are going to step in and save you. That is a big, big deal. Now, McCarthy has then turned that into, I'm not going to do any sort of deals with the Democrats. I'm up or down with the Republicans. I'm not. I think if it was on the table, he might have done it. But I think it was taken off the table pretty fast.
Yeah, I think the problem for McCarthy is that he can't be trusted. That's what Spanberger right. talked about. Honestly, it's actually what both sides seem to agree on here, is that McCarthy, he's been going to his hardline Republicans and promising one thing, and then he's been promising something else to Democrats. And, you know, a lot of what it seems like his camp wants to promise Democrats in exchange for their support is that he would uphold his previous agreements. So it's like, if you've ever been in a negotiation before, this is a no-go, and I'm glad Democrats are standing up to him on this. Like, essentially saying, if you do this next thing for me, I'll do the thing I promised I would do before. And that's just not enough.
You know, anybody who has a 10-year-old, no, like, this is a regular negotiation that gets shot down in my house. It's like, hey, no, you're supposed to do the dishes you're supposed to like put the dishes away out of the dishwasher in the morning before you do anything else. Yeah, but if you do this, then I will do it. No. See, you're just supposed to do it. That's how it works.
Right.
And yeah, now, very similar.
I could see some Democrats playing the game of the motion to vacate. The voting present. If McCarthy tinkered with the rules of the House, which I'll get back to. But here's a tweet from Jake Sherman, who's from Punch Bowl and seems to be really knowledgeable about this stuff. He lays out a few scenarios about what can happen here. One is McCarthy wins, which, as Jake Sherman noted, is unlikely. Two is McCarthy loses on the floor but tries to grind it out with several more votes. It's a repeat of what happened in January, so he like keeps negotiating as this moves along. Three is that McCarthy loses and leaves, and there's a scramble for leadership. Scalise, who's in the middle of medical treatment and doesn't seem to be available, is the leading contender. Emmer, there's a couple other options, but nobody even Gates seems to be floating any names. In 98, the precedent here is delay pushed Denny Hassert into Speaker's chair. That'll happen within a day. And then the fourth option is that this could drag out for a while with no Speaker. And they will have to stay in session until they find a new speaker. And that seems, that seems like the most likely scenario, which is really scary. So I think although it makes a lot of sense for Democrats to be principled on this, I have to admit that although that's my instinct, I'm not sure I understand what the world looks like without a speaker. And so I'm not fully comfortable with the chaos right now. And in that sense, I think it's important for Democrats to be principled, but also to stay at the table and just hear out ideas for how do we resolve this.
I'll tell you why I'm comfortable with the chaos. I'm just worried about the result of the chaos, but I'm comfortable with the chaos. I'm comfortable with no speaker because the Republican control of the House is, for the most part, going to produce nothing in the next 20, 30 days. Of real value, right? Like, you're going to have to pass a budget again. And, you know, you're going to have to pass either a budget or continuing resolution in 40 some days now. But in the short term, it's like again, going back to when I was in the state house and it was controlled by Republicans, the way it worked was you couldn't filibuster, but you had, once you got the mic, you had 15 minutes that you could talk for. And so our whole job as you got toward the end of session and they were trying to pass all this terrible stuff was to get up and talk for 15 minutes as much as you could. It was like a relay. Just get up, talk about whatever you could for 15 minutes and try and keep them from stopping debate, because the longer it took the House to do anything, the less likely it was that really, really bad stuff got sent on to the Senate and possibly to the governor. The same deal here. So if it goes for a bit, I think that's probably all right. It's also going to put on display once again how incredibly disorganized and, you know, how much they hate each other, frankly. I mean, a fight between McCarthy and Gates. I mean, it's like, it's just one of those things. It's like when this could never happen, but if the Raiders played the Yankees in like a basketball game, you know, like if I'm really stretching this analogy, I would somehow root for both to lose. And I don't know if they could, but that's what's happening here.
I don't know.
That's the dumbest analogy I've ever brought out on the show.
But I think you get it. Here's one option, right? Which is Democrats play the game. I'm going to play this out, right? They do the voting. Enough of them vote present to change the math. Here's the problem with that. Unless they change the rules around how many votes it takes to keep pulling these motions, to call into question the speaker, this will just keep happening. And actually, McCarthy will lose more votes over time from his Republican colleagues who see him cooperating with Democrats. Mm-hmm. So that's why the rule change has to be a part of this. Like, if the Democrats in any way make life easier for McCarthy, he needs things. And this is what I think it was Jayapal said, which is like, it was somebody, either Jayapal or somebody within the Progressive Caucus said, the only scenario which we would even consider talking to Republicans on this is if whatever is agreed to is codified in something binding at the outset, because we don't trust them at all. And I think she was alluding to rules changes. And that makes a little bit of sense to me. Like,
that's basically like a power sharing agreement that's actually put into the House rules is what they're describing, right?
Now, that would be in the interest of Democrats, because then you start to see things like the Hunter Biden investigation could kill things like that. You can get Ukraine funding through, because it looks like the good example is Ukraine funding, which they stripped from the temporary, you know, we didn't even talk about the fact that they temporarily authorized spending for the next few months, but cut Ukraine funding from that. It seems like an up or down vote on Ukraine funding would pass, right? So these are the types of things that you, as Democrats, you start to stack up. All right, what kind of votes could we push forward if we change the rules in a certain ways? Could we kill the Hunter Biden nonsense? Like, you start to go through all this and say, all right, what are the pros and cons of going through this? And that's why I think being at the table is probably helpful.
Yeah. All right. So there's a Gates video uploaded here. This is him, I think, explaining his rationale.
Yeah, I want people to hear this because, okay.
Of the agreement that he made with us in January, he accelerated the instances of breach. Like, after I laid out the breach, he went and violated the 72-hour rule. After I laid out the breach, he violated the 100 million no amendment suspension rule. So he seems to be reverting to the very unfortunate muscle memory of Washington, D.C., that has put our nation atop a $33 trillion debt that has led to, you know, $2 trillion annual deficits in our near future, and the rapid global de-dollarization of the economy. I mean, you look at the BRICS system, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, they're moving away from the dollar. And just in August, they added six new countries, including G20 economies in the Western Hemisphere and Gulf monarchies. Moreover, you saw U.S. News say that the number one economic trend of 2023 is de-dollarization globally. This worries me. You all get all worked up that there's going to be some uncomfortable, chaotic moment that I'll feel pressure from conservatives or Democrats or whomever. I feel the judgment of history. I feel the weight of that. I worry that when the history books are written about this country going down, that my name is going to be on the board of directors here. And if this country's going down and if we're losing the dollar, I am going down fighting. And I don't care if that means fighting Republicans.
Yeah, so, like, I have a couple things here.
Matt Gaetz.
Okay. Number one, if you're just listening to this on audio, the thing you cannot see is that there's a huge gaggle of reporters around Gaetz. And if you're asking yourself, what is Gaetz up to here? Because he's not going to be speaker. This is what he's up to. It's the attention. That's what he wants in this whole thing. It's all these people asking him what his opinion is, because otherwise nobody cares what his opinion is. But now he's like the hot sort of interview in Washington. That's
I mean,
one.
We're what? Is, oh, yeah. We're like 1 year maybe removed from him not getting indicted for like child sex trafficking, I believe. Like, yeah.
Something like
that. I mean, quite a rebound for this fella.
Yeah, I forget what it was, but it was something involving an underage girl. Yeah. Two is this de-dollarization thing. We don't have enough time, and this is not the podcast for it, but he couldn't be more full of shit. Like, this is a guy who doesn't want the government to pay its bills, right? Now, what's the worst thing that could happen to the standing of the U.S. dollar, which, by the way, is doing quite well? Like, a lot of the things he's saying are just fully false. But let's just pretend that the dollar was in some kind of decline. The worst thing you could do for the U.S. dollar and its strength is to threaten to not pay our bills, which he has been a leading supporter of doing, or not pay your bills. Like, those are two things that are really bad for the dollar standing. I mean, I feel even disgusting even taking his argument seriously, but these are the things he's talking about. And the third is, like, he talks about the debt, which other people who've announced that they're supporting him have also mentioned. It's like this debt is out of control. And longtime listeners will know this. We don't have to go through the data. When Republicans are in charge of Congress and in charge of the presidency, the debt is worse than whenever there's Democratic control. Like, this is a historical fact that goes back many, many decades. So, and even, like, this is actually something, if you watched the Republican debate last week, that, you know, it seems most people on that stage agreed on, which was that Donald Trump was as responsible for inflation as anybody else because he ran up the debt during his time. So it's just a bunch of nonsense. Yeah.
These guys rediscover that there's a debt every time that there's a Democrat in the White House, right? So, like, that's just how this works. That's how they talk about it. You're right that Matt Gaetz just wants attention. He sold, a lot of the caucus on it, right? Like, we've seen other announcement videos from, well, let's if we have it, what's the other guy, Salty, who I sent you? I can't remember all these jerks' names. Tim Burchett, thank you, the dude from Tennessee. Let's listen to a few seconds of him, and it'll sound very similar.
Kevin McCarthy's my friend, and I hate to lose him as a friend, but I had a choice between that and my conscience and what my conscience tells me to do. My conscience tells me that we're $33 trillion in debt. We took off the whole month of August knowing that September was going to come around. Thus, every year, the end of our budgetary year, fiscal year, and there is no urgency. And then we just do a continued resolution, kicking the can 45 days down the road, and then that will be right up against the Thanksgiving holiday, and then we'll put in an omnibus, which is a big bill. It's more spending, more grease, more lobbyists, and more special interest, and the big boys will stay in power. And at some point, we just got to say enough is enough, folks.
All right. The reason I wanted to play this is this points to a very interesting thing about legislative bodies. And it's like any other workplace, right? Or high school that you've ever been in. There tends to be very strong personalities that influence some of the less strong personalities. And what's wild about that in a place like Congress is like that dude Burchett, I looked him up. He was the mayor of somewhere in Tennessee. And then he ran for Congress and won. Like, you know, as a rule, people who get elected to Congress, for most of them, they have some pretty strong personalities. Doesn't mean they have like strong brains, but it doesn't mean they don't. It just the two things they don't always automatically equal one another. But it tends to be people with some degree of dynamism who got themselves elected to something. But even though that's the case, there are people who have seniority, people who understand how the media works, people who can work the system, who can influence the other people. So what you end up with is you have somebody like Gaetz, who is just super cynical. He's the kind of guy who in state legislatures is pushing the idea that there's fraud and that's why we got to have photo ID and all this. And then you have people like this Burchett character, as far as I can tell, or Burchett, or however you say it, who really seem to believe this stuff. Like Tim Burchett, Bert, whatever, however you say his name, is talking about this. Tim is talking about this. Like, he really believes if they get a different speaker, we're going to zero out $33 trillion in debt. Now, you don't have to know anything about Matt Gaetz to listen to what he said and go, that dude doesn't believe a word of what he's saying, right? But a guy like Timmy there, he's buying into it. And that's just the interesting thing about this, is that people like Gaetz can bring other people along, and you get a guy like Timmy who genuinely thinks he's making a vote of conscience. But what it all comes down to, and what people should take from this, what they should talk to their friends about when this comes up, is that what guys like Gaetz and his followers are ultimately upset about is that Kevin McCarthy worked with the other party to keep the government from closing. Like, that's why they're mad, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why they're mad.
Well, Tim Burchett, what I find fascinating, he's on the government oversight committee. So you'd be like, he wants urgency around the debt. So this guy must be like appalled by all this time they're spending on Hunter Biden. But if you do a simple Google search, yeah, You'll find quite the opposite. He seems pretty jazzed about that inquiry and seemed to spend the whole month of August talking about nothing but Hunter Biden. And so, yeah, I don't know. This is going to keep developing. I think as over the course of this podcast, we're just going to have to keep updating this, even though we move to other stories, including, it seems, Hakeem Jeffries just had a dear colleague letter And he said, given their unwillingness, given their unwillingness to break from MAGA extremism in an authentic and comprehensive manner, House Democratic leadership will vote yes on the pending Republican motion to vacate the chair. So they're going to vote yes.
So that he's done. I mean, McCarthy's done now. Let's see. He says, we confront a serious, solemn, and sober moment. The vote that the House will cast this week in connection with the motion to vacate the chair is not about any one individual. Our responsibility as members of Congress relates to the Constitution, the principle of good governance, and the people we are privileged to serve, nothing more and nothing less. So let's see. We remain willing to find common ground on an enlightened path forward. And then you have the stuff about extreme Republican colleagues have shown no willingness to do the same. It's now the responsibility of the GOP members to end the House Republican civil war. Very good. Very good framing. Given their unwillingness to break, and this is where he says, from MAGA extremism in an authentic and comprehensive manner, House Democratic leadership will vote yes in the pending. So he's like, look, he's basically saying, here's the deal. You don't need to waste any more time, McCarthy, trying to get the votes on this motion to vacate. We're just going to fast forward to the part where you all have a brand new vote for speaker. Like, we don't need, you don't need to worry anymore about whether you're going to need a new speaker. We are telling you, you need a new speaker. So just get to the part where you fight it out for who the new speaker is going to be. That's pretty interesting.
I'm just not sure this is going to be better for us. That's my one worry. I would vote with him, to be clear.
What's better? That's the point, though. What's better, right? Like, McCarthy is, I mean, you know, but any further than you can throw him.
This is the lowest bar, but McCarthy has now attempted to keep the government running. I know this is the lowest of lowest bars. Like, is there any chance who replaces him would do that? I don't know. You know, and I think, like, part of it has to do with, like, intra-Republican fighting, right? A lot of these, like, I don't want to call them moderates, but more vulnerable Republicans would not vote for somebody who wouldn't fund the government, right? Mm-hmm. But then these other, like, I just can't, I don't know where this is going to go, you know?
I mean, my thing, what I would want to be able to do, and clearly there's an impediment to this, your ideal situation as the Democrats, is that you're in a position where you can say to McCarthy, we will save you. You will owe us, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is McCarthy is too afraid of the extreme right. I mean, that's why he said, I'm not going to make any sort of deal where I promise anything to the Democrats, right? It's interesting that we live in a political landscape, that's not true. The right wing, we all live in it, but the right wing has created a political landscape where Kevin McCarthy feels that it is in his long-term political best interest, his long-term general career best interest, whatever he chooses to do after Congress, if this is, you know, the end of at least his time in leadership in Congress, and like his long-term just quality of life, not getting harassed all the time everywhere he goes, to not make a deal with the Democrats and therefore keep the government open and try and do things that are bipartisan that might actually create progress. Like, that's wild. That, like, it doesn't make sense for him to do those things. And I'm saying, like, obviously it makes sense for the country. I'm just saying, I don't think that's much of a consideration for Kevin McCarthy. I think it's probably a consideration. I just don't think it's huge. We're going to go to a quick break, and then the House should be back in session pretty soon after this break. So, as they say, stay tuned. Heart health and staying healthy, especially when you have a family that you want to be able to spend as much time with as possible, is so, so important. We all have a heartfelt reason to support our blood pressure. In fact, more than half the U.S. population would benefit from blood pressure support. SuperBeats Heart Chews are an easy and convenient way to support healthy blood pressure, and they promote heart-healthy energy. Paired with a healthy lifestyle, the antioxidants in SuperBeats are clinically shown to be nearly 2 times more effective at promoting normal blood pressure than a healthy lifestyle alone. And with over 30,000 five-star reviews and counting, SuperBeats Heart Chews are having their moment. SuperBeats Heart Chews are incredibly delicious and so much better than any alternative supplements out there. I take my SuperBeats Heart Chews each morning, and it really kickstarts my morning routine. After taking my SuperBeats Heart Chews, I feel like I have more energy and I'm ready to take on the day. SuperBeats Heart Chews are plant-based and so easy to add to your routine. No pills to swallow, no ingredients to mix or prepare. double your potential with Superbeats Heart Chews. Get a free 30-day supply of Superbeats Heart Chews and 15% off your first order by going to getsuperbeats.com and using promo code MAJORITY. That's getsuperbeats.com, code MAJORITY. Do you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics and makes temperature-regulating bedding so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Diana and I have been sleeping on Miracle Made sheets for about a week now, and we are a couple, there are many of them out there, who have a strong distinction between our preferences when it comes to temperature. And so this has been kind of a game changer because I like it to be colder in the room. And the only time that she's able to accommodate that is when she wears like socks and long pants and all that. I mean, she has to bundle up. So it has been much better. We're much closer to meeting in the middle on a temperature after over 20 years because of Miracle Made sheets. The sheets are infused with silver that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth, leaving them to stay cleaner and fresh three times longer than other sheets. No more gross odors. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of gross odors in the bed, but perhaps if she were here, she would rebut that claim. Either way, don't have to worry about it because of Miracle Made sheets. Go to trymiracle.com/majority to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo majority at checkout, you'll get three free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/majority and use the code MAJORITY to claim your free three-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/majority to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Okay, we're going to keep a close eye on this. The House is going to come back in any minute here, so stay with us. We're going to go back to that. But in the meantime, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, there's Trump trials now, not just Trump indictments, not just Trump lawsuits. So we're going to talk about that while we wait to see what the House is doing. And then as soon as the House goes back in, we're going to go back to this. I don't even want to call it the Kevin McCarthy show anymore because it looks like it's not the Kevin McCarthy show.
Look at this. Look at how professional this is. We have a little house.
This little feed in the corner. Amazing.
Yeah. Shout out to C-SPAN. We've seen
pretty big time.
All right. So, Jason, from what I could tell from abroad, and I'm going to need you to fill in a little bit of this. So we already got our motion last week, which basically decided so much for us in this civil trial in New York over Trump's business fraud. But Trump, I think, did not have to show up to this trial. This is a bench trial with the judge. But he decided to show up at least for the first few days. And he was just extremely agitated in court as New York State Attorney General and her team, Tish James, entered the courtroom. And she was pushing for a $250 million judgment against Trump on these business fraud charges. There are six claims remaining in this civil trial relating to insurance fraud, conspiracy, and falsifying documents. And this is, outside of what was already decided at bench last week. One little interesting fact that I think has gone underreported is that Trump could, he's complaining that he didn't get a jury, Jason, but they didn't file any motions requesting a jury. This judge was asked about it. He was like, yeah, nobody's asked for a jury, which is really weird.
I can't figure out. I mean, is it an error? Are they that bad that they just forgot to say we want a jury? Or is it like,
nobody knows. I don't think anybody knows. It hasn't been demonstrated. I think it's really hard with Trump because they'll never be honest about what's going on.
Right.
You could imagine they didn't want to subject themselves to a Manhattan jury, sure. But a Manhattan judge, I don't know.
And he's like walking out of the courtroom and just crapping all over the judge too. Like,
yeah.
It's
really crazy.
So it just flummoxes me as a former civil trial attorney. I just can't imagine not wanting to be in front of a jury. Unless the theory is, look, we're going to lose either way. Let's at least make it so that Trump can say, hey, the judge is what screwed us. I don't understand.
But a bench trial is faster, as you know. So, like, you'd think they'd want to delay it a little bit. So, I don't know. But it is really odd, the whole spectacle of this. And it just, I think we've entered a new phase of this whole thing. It is jarring to see Trump in a courtroom on trial, even though this is civil charges. And I think the fact that he's dealing with so many cases maybe is why he potentially made an error here. Like, maybe they're just, like, overwhelmed as a legal team and are making mistakes.
First of all, let's go ahead and watch the video of him. I think it's during the break in the trial, right? I think that's what it is, and what he had to say.
There's absolutely no fraud. They all made money. They're all happy, 100% happy. And I think very importantly is everything, many, many warnings, page one, page two, and many pages. It says, please, you must understand that you have to do your own due diligence and you have to, above all, do your own research and analysis. Do not rely on anything. Do not rely on the financial statements. Also, the financial statements are very strong in terms of cash, liquidity, and everything else. This case is a scam. There can't be fraud when you've told institutions to do their own work. This case is a fraud, and it's a scam. Thank you very much.
Why is it a scam?
How is it a scam?
Okay, first, for those who are wondering what the House is doing, they're currently voting on another spending bill at the moment, and they're, I assume, going to get back to the shenanigans. But while they're doing that, we're talking about this. Okay, a couple of things that came out at me from that clip. One, Trump doesn't read more than 2 pages of any document. It says on page one, page two, probably other pages. Like he can't even bother to look at the one sentence disclaimer and find it on like a third page. His attention span is up. And then next, he says, well, we told them don't rely on any of this stuff we're giving you. Which is sort of an admission that this stuff we're giving you is no good, right? But then his next thing he says is, but, you know, the statements we gave clearly demonstrate that I have very strong financials. So it's like, I'm a very rich guy. But if in the case I lied about being a very rich guy and claimed to be a more rich guy than I am, I mean, it's really not my job. My job is to lie. Your job is to catch me lying. Like, therefore, it's not fraud. Like, that's a rather extraordinary concept of how the law works.
Yeah, and his son, Eric, was also in the courtroom. He's a co-defendant in this case, and he was relatively quiet, which I think is smart in his case.
Yes.
Although he's hitched to his father. Just imagine having to go to court because of, and sitting next to your father in the courtroom, and your father is just digging deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper on this. And remember, this is a civil case, right? So this is immune to pardons. Now, you would imagine he's banking on some kind of right-wing judge down the line reversing this. That's mm-hmm. probably what he's banking on.
I also think that, people are asking, why is it that he bothered to show up for this one? He didn't show up for the sexual assault civil trial. We don't know whether he's going to actually show up for the criminal trials. He has mostly hinted at the idea that he won't. I think the answer is this. This one is about money. And I don't just mean like he's worried he's going to lose money. He's lost money in the others. This is about the one thing about him that he really, truly cares people believing. The one perception of him, which is that he's a very rich and successful guy. At the end of the day, that's what this is about. And so, Donald, and I just think it says a lot about the dude's character, right? Like if he has, to the extent that he has any, you're going to accuse me of sexual assault? Yeah, it's fine. I don't care. I'm not going to show up. Oh, you're going to accuse me of not being as rich as I said? Then I'm going to be there to show that I'm every bit as rich as I said. So I just think that says a lot about the appearances the dude's been putting up for a long time.
Well, well, it looks like we'll have plenty more opportunities to see him at trial over the course of the next year. And so this is just the beginning. Let's turn to John Kelly.
Before we turn, though, can I just say one thought that came to me a little too late there? I was trying to come up with the analogy. I'm 0 for 1 on analogy so far in this episode. I'm trying to come up with the analogy of like why it is that calling Trump not as rich as he is the thing that stirs him up. And I think the analogy is it's like calling Marty McFly chicken. Like, yeah, it's like that's the one thing that it will stop him in his tracks and have him pirouette, turn around and fight you. Anyway, I had to say that.
I think that's right.
I feel I'm 1 for 2. All right. Now.
All right. Well, let's talk about John Kelly, who I didn't think we would ever revisit again, but he was the longest serving White House chief of staff for Donald Trump, which, you know, that's a qualified record out if there ever was one. He said the following to Jake Tapper. He said, "What can I add that has not already been said? A person that thinks those who defend their country in uniform or are shot down or seriously wounded in combat or spend years being tortured as POWs are all suckers because there's nothing in it for them. A person that did not want to be seen in the presence of military amputees because it doesn't look good for me. A person who demonstrated open contempt for a Gold Star family, for all Gold Star families on TV during the 2016 campaign. And rants that our most precious heroes who gave their lives in America's defense are losers and wouldn't visit their graves in France." There's more here. You know, he says a person who's not truthful regarding his own position on the protection of unborn life, on women, on minorities, on evangelical Christians, on Jews, on working men and women, a person that has no idea what
America stands for. That part, by the way, is interesting. That is him hinting at, I heard him say really racist things about all these groups, and I heard him say that he really doesn't care about the issue of abortion. That's really what
for sure.
John Kelly has more tea to spill is what that line means to me.
Oh, for sure. I could stop there. I mean, there's so much more, but he confirms like accounts of Trump basically saying he doesn't want to visit graves of, you know, World War II, you know, killed in action, because they're losers. Like, why would I want to visit losers? I mean, and doesn't want to be filmed, you know, photoed with amputees because it makes them look bad. This is not surprising, but it is jarring just to hear the details, even after all these years of Trump, just to hear how horrible of a human being he truly is. And how just like he does the things that you'd never think a Republican would be allowed to get away with, given what they have claimed to stand for, the patriotism that they pretend to stand for.
Here's the way I think this could matter politically for Trump, and particularly in the general election, which is, if you think back to the 2020 election, one of the things that happened that was very interesting, was that had not really happened in the past, was that Biden ended up actually winning, at least polling indicated, very narrowly winning the military vote, and particularly the active duty military vote. And that was a very big deal because Democrats have, over the last, I don't know, generation, not typically won that. Now, people think, and we've talked about this before, but people think, oh, well, the military is so Republican because of this or that. No, the military leans Republican for the same reason that any workplace that is overwhelmingly male and disproportionately drawn from the South and the Midwest would lean Republican. Like, you show me, a place that makes widgets and you tell me most of the people who work here are dudes from the South and the Midwest, I'd be like, the majority of those employees vote Republican. And that's what's going on with the military. It's not something about the military. And so it was a big deal that active duty military and I believe Military Times took the poll right before the election, that the majority of them were going to vote for Biden. And this was right after the Atlantic article that quoted without attribution John Kelly. And it was basically that General Kelly had said these things to people. He had complained to people in his social orbit, and it had gotten back through rumor to the Atlantic, and they were not able to, as I recall, confirm that with Kelly. So they had to get people on the record saying they heard Kelly say that to them. So it was sort of secondhand. So the reason I think this can matter a lot politically is, and this is something Democrats don't want to talk about, but is that not because of necessarily the Afghanistan withdrawal. A lot of people think that that's the reason. No, it's more because of the relative inattention paid to the remaining folks in Afghanistan post the withdrawal, that there are a fair amount of vets, at least of my generation, who are pretty unhappy with Biden over that issue. You know, I'm going to vote for Biden. I support Biden. But I have qualms with a lot of that. And I have things that I recognize that if Trump had been president, nobody would have gotten out and it would have been 20 times worse. But that's not really the standard we're working with. Right. Right. And so he's not going to be in the same strong position naturally going into this election that he was, relative terms for a Democrat, strong with the military and with the veteran vote. And so bringing this sort of stuff back to the forefront, I think, is a big deal. And it's interesting that Kelly decided now to confirm it. And I think it's clearly because Trump called for the execution of General Milley, the outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And, you know, not surprising that General Kelly was like, no, screw you, man. I'm going to confirm all this stuff that I was nice enough to be quiet about.
Yeah, it's just when you do the tally of Trump's sins, you know, trying to pressure a foreign ally in Ukraine to investigate his domestic political enemies, harboring, you know, top secret classified information and bragging about it, sharing it, denigrating people who serve the United States and protect the United States. I mean, you just go down the list, you know, spurring an insurrection, refusing to give up his power until forced, like, you know, pushing a conspiracy of fake electors. Like, it's honestly like they're so varied and horrible. Like each one of those would be the worst scandal of our lifetime. And that's just a few of them. It just blows my mind. Like, and this is the kind of thing you just don't hear people talk about a lot. Like this particular one, like a lot of what Kelly said was fairly known. You know, it's just, he was obviously a source for a lot of these stories before. And now he's just putting his name to it.
There's a, for those listening, and if you have like a veteran in your life who's maybe on the fence politically and you want to win them over, this is what I would say to them, is that all of these guys, Trump, Tuberville, who I think this week said he was really more military than Mark Kelly, who's a combat veteran pilot who was an astronaut, you know, like these guys and the people who vote with them because they feel this way. We all know these folks. Here's who they are, and this is what I say to fellow vets. These guys are the guys who, when they find out you were a veteran, they get this, they didn't serve, and that's fine that they didn't serve, but then they get this enormous sense of like unnecessary inferiority and insecurity that comes up and just bubbles up within them. And here's how it manifests itself. They pull out their phone and they show you, if you're a vet, pictures of their guns. And they think this happens to me. And they think like, we're going to connect. And I'm gonna be like, yeah, man, you and I are the same. Like, that's what they're going for. And those people, we find those people make us very uncomfortable. They make veterans very uncomfortable. And that's who these guys are, is they are those guys who are very uncomfortable. I served with this dude in the House, in the State House. This is an episode where I've mentioned the State House three times. This dude named Mark Parkinson, who, he had a high and tight haircut, you know, like the all the way up here, and he just super, like, you know, the one you get at basic training. He had it all the time. Like, I was still in the reserves, and like, I had some hair on the top of my head, you know, I didn't. And so he had that. His license plate said, it was like, just NRA something, you know. He always wore like tactical, like, you know, stuff with lots of zipper pockets on the shirt. Anyway, that guy, like, I remember I came back from a drill weekend where there had been some Army National Guard, like public affairs team there, and they had created a video out of the training we were doing, and I'm on the video, and he comes up and he says something to me about, man, that was some good acting you did. I really believed you were like a real soldier. And I just remember being like, oh, Mark, you're confused. No, see, I didn't just get a haircut. I'm actually in the Army. But they're all Mark Parkinson. That's who all these guys are. You know, it's Trump saying about the mass shooting at, I think it was it the Stoneman Douglas? Was it, you know, I can't, there's so many, sadly, that I can't remember, where he's like, I would have run back in and taken on the shooter. I mean, they're just so full of it, and it makes you uncomfortable. And so when you have a vet friend in your life, be like, this is who these guys are. It's this guy. Can't vote for him.
Oh, man. Well, that at least should make it into an ad as we round the bend into the general election.
Yeah.
Let's come back to this House vote. So they're still voting on the spending bill, so we may not get to it in this episode. So we may have to end on a cliffhanger, but there is this news out from the House Democratic leaders. They expect 4 to 5 absences. So that changes the math a little bit. Hard to say based on this, but here's a graphic on GOP votes right now. So in Gaetz's camp is Gaetz, Crane, Good, Biggs, Bruchette, your boy, Rosendale. Undecided, Sparks, Mace, Clyde, Gosar, Luna, Wesley Hunt, Buck, Ogles, Cloud, and Boebert. But Boebert gave a thumbs up to Gaetz on the floor. Sparks is apparently a no on... I think a no means no on Gaetz.
So he's a no on the motion to vacate, right? So yes.
Yeah.
So he's a yes vote. Okay, we're getting these little messages from the producer. So he's a yes vote on the motion to vacate. I'm just going to, look, I don't want to remove the tension here, but I'm going to make my prediction, which is like McCarthy's done. Like he's not speaker.
Yeah.
Within a few hours here, he's not speaker. And I don't know what's going to happen after that. But I just don't see... I mean, last time, he had to make a deal with Gaetz in order to become the speaker. So I just don't see how he does this. I suppose the absences could... Yeah, the absences could save him, right? Because then your math changes. It's down to 4 or 5. But Gaetz has made clear that he's going to do this over and over again. So these absences aren't going to last forever. So, if it's not today, it's soon, affords...
What is going on with these absences, by the way? Oh, there's two GOP absences, too. It's a big deal. Was this planned, or is this... Are these real absences, I guess, is my question, or is this Democrats giving him a little bit of room to maneuver without having to own it?
I doubt it. I mean, think about it. I mean, just without knowing anything about it, you got a 435-person workplace. Some people aren't going to be there some days, you know?
Yeah.
And also, they're all 500 years old. So, sometimes they got to go back to that place where Superman had to go to get their life force, you know, reinvigorated. You know? So talk to Marlon Brando for a minute.
Well, okay. I think it would probably make sense for us to end on a cliffhanger, Jason. What do you think? Maybe do one for us?
Sure. Before one for us, let me just tell my one Kevin McCarthy story that I've told before, which is, it's 2016. I'm running for the U.S. Senate, and I don't remember what place it was, someplace in D.C., where there was this small little fundraiser being held for me. And it was like this one dude who was a D.C. type guy who liked... The thing about being a Senate challenger is like no special interests that aren't like your traditional Democratic constituencies really backed me hardly at all, right? Like I had like your Democratic aligned lobbyists would show up when I would go to DC, and they were like people who were really just political activists from some state who had landed in Washington. But I can't remember the group, but there was one group that for whatever reason, they had a bone to pick with Roy Blunt, my opponent, who was the incumbent. And so they held some little thing for me. And it was seriously like 6 people around a table upstairs in a DC thing. And I probably raised just about no money, but it was 4 or 5 lobbyists together. So they had a lobbyist quorum, I guess. And so Kevin McCarthy was drawn to it like a fly to light or however. Scott, I am just striking out on all analogies. Apparently, I can't talk on
moth
Tuesdays.
To flame.
It's only Wednesdays.
Moth to
moth
flame.
To flame. Thank you very much. A fly to light. Good God. So anyway, moth to flame. Thank you. So then McCarthy comes in, and he doesn't really realize... It's early in my campaign, so like I'm not the guy from the gun ad. People don't really know me. He doesn't realize... He just thinks I'm another dude in a tie at the table. And he just starts holding court because he knows all these lobbyists. And then he brings in some other goofy Republican congressman. And the next thing I know, I'm having a little small fundraiser in D.C. and McCarthy and these Republicans are there. And we're all sitting around. And so finally, I introduce myself. And the host guy is like, Kevin, just before you came in, Jason was talking about why he thinks we need redistricting reform. And and why we ought to go to a system that's totally nonpartisan. And he's like, oh, it's terrible. Da, da, da. And he's like, what are you going to do? You're not going to create a competitive district out of this or this or this. And I was like, yeah, but I've looked at your district and it could totally be competitive. And he was like, and it was just really funny because like, it was only then that he realized like, oh, I just walked into a Democratic event. And I guess there's really no point to this story other than to tell you that the concept of a creature of Washington is like a real thing. That Kevin McCarthy is just a dude who just goes from one assembled group of lobbyists and power brokers in Washington to the next. And that's his constituency. When you have Timmy Burchett talking about lobbyists getting the wheels greased, like that's the thing he's right about. Is that that's who McCarthy is. He is just a longtime creature of the place. And his constituency, it's not voters. It's just the people he's around the most. And that's
my
Washington
question is,
people.
How many of these Timmy Burchetts are clean, though? Probably none of them.
No, you know? None of them. Like, none of them. But he's but what he's saying is correct. Right. And at the end of the day, what Timmy would like is for more of those people to pay attention to him. I'm not saying he's pure. I'm just saying he's right. He just got there a different way. All right, one for us.
We'll be fascinated to see where this goes. Yeah, one for us. I'm in
You're
Sri
in
Lanka.
Sri Lanka.
I
talk
took,
about
so
that.
I left my apartment in Brooklyn at 8:30 in the morning on Friday as the rainstorm was just barreling down on the city. I probably live 15 miles to LaGuardia Airport. It took me 4 hours in an Uber to get to LaGuardia Airport.
Oh my God. Traffic. At the beginning of international travel?
I left at 8:30 in the morning for a flight that was taking off at like 11:50 a.m., which you'd think I would make. God. I get to the airport after the flight was supposed to take off, but it was delayed by like 10 minutes. So I get through security. They hold me at security for an extra 15 minutes because the scanning machine was broken. So I'm like, there's no way I made this. At this point, it's like 12:15 for an 11:50 flight. I somehow get on the flight. I fly to Amsterdam. I have a 10-hour layover in Amsterdam. Sorry, I fly to Toronto. And then I go from Toronto to Amsterdam. I have a 10-hour layover in Amsterdam. I then get to Mumbai. I get stopped by immigration in Mumbai because it was like a question about like, because I was connecting to Sri Lanka. And they were like, they were confused about like my visa and all this. So they held me for a few hours there. And then I had like another extra 10 hours there. I then fly to Sri Lanka. I landed Sri Lanka and drove 7 hours. And I got here just in time on Sunday night, my time, which was 10:30, which was exactly as the Bills kickoff was starting. So I turned on like this illegal website to watch the Bills crush the Miami Dolphins. It was quite a day. I literally left at 8:30 in the morning and didn't get to my place here in Sri Lanka until 10:30 at night on Sunday.
It's funny because
10:30 Sunday.
You were obviously very excited about that game. You were like texting me. I didn't even think about the fact that you were on the other side of the world. That's they looked good. They looked good. All right. Well, I can't really top that in terms of a one for us. I guess the only thing I'd say, a fun thing, is that last night, so I do walk-up songs for True's baseball team. I don't know if I've told you this, that I recorded like a voiceover. It's actually really fun. I should play this for you. And True changed his walk-up song. So I do the voice, and then they have like really cool like hip-hop songs for 10 seconds. And so the 10-year-olds are walking to the plate like with enormous amounts of swagger, right? And True, for his little sister who was going to be at the game, asked me to change his walk-up song, and I want you to hear it. So it's my
number
voice here.
56, True Candor.
And
it's the shark song, the baby shark song.
Yeah, and Bella went crazy. She was like, "This baby shark!" And she got up. She was so excited. And then, you know, she wanted me to keep playing it. And I was like, "Well, how do you explain a walk-up song to a 3-year-old?" And so then she took Diana's phone and she pulled Baby Shark up on the phone. And so True's batting, and Bella's up at the fence holding the phone up at full volume, being like, "True, listen, it's Baby Shark." It was adorable. And then True doubled the right. It was pretty cool.
Oh, good. I was gonna say that would be distracting. That's good concentration on his part.
It was a very sweet, very adorable little moment. So, all right, well, we'll leave everybody on a cliffhanger. I guess go from us to either whatever's next on Midas, and if nothing's coming up next, then you can go to C-SPAN to watch what unfolds. Remember to subscribe to Majority 54 wherever you listen to audio podcasts. Just search Majority 54 and please leave a 5-star review. Thank you to the Midas Mighty. Remember, we all have a platform. Make sure to use yours today.